This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, at Google Play, at Reason.com, or wherever you find podcasts easily accessible. Rate and review us while you're there. Today, my guest is Jacob Solem, longtime Reason senior editor, multiple recidivist book author, writer about a lot of stuff, but especially drug policy. Jacob, would you agree that drug policy is your kind of go-to topic?
Yeah, it's one of the main things I write about, that and civil liberties issues.
All right. So you're already backing away from the drugs?
Well, I mean, drugs.
Yeah. And civil liberties.
It is a civil liberties issue.
It's the ultimate civil liberties issue.
Yeah, it really is.
Right?
Controlling your own consciousness is kind of important
as
a civil liberty.
I guess so. Yeah. You know, what about Second Amendment rights? So Second Amendment rights, are they above drug rights?
Well, the right to self-preservation, I suppose you could argue, is prior to the right to control.
See, this has already gone disastrously off course.
If you don't preserve your life, then you've got no consciousness to control.
But so. I mean, but if you are really drunk and high and you have a gun, like, you know, maybe bad things are going to happen too, right?
Could
Do those rights ever come into conflict?
Could be. I don't think, properly speaking.
Okay. Now. Okay. So, well, I apologize to all of the last person who's still listening to this, Jacob and I are talking in Los Angeles. We've worked together for 25 years or more, or something like that. We rarely see each other, but we're both in Los Angeles to celebrate Reason's 50th anniversary. And I wanted to talk to Jacob especially about a great piece he has in the latest issue of Reason, our 50th anniversary, about Michael Pollan's book about how to change your mind. And it's about the new science of psychedelics. And Jacob wrote a piece called Who Controls Your Cortex? Jacob, what is the thesis of your piece, Who Controls Your Cortex?
Well, I mean, I think the main point that I try to make is, even though Michael Pollan seems to...
Is it Pollan? Do you know that?
Or? I don't even know for sure.
Okay. All right. No, I'm just asking.
I say Pollan. Maybe Pollan.
Yeah.
For all I know. But he argues in the book, pretty much accepts the conventional view that Timothy Leary kind of fucked things up for LSD and ruined it for everybody.
Right.
By taking it out of the laboratory, urging, you know, young people throughout America to tune in, turn out, and drop out.
Right.
And taking something that actually started out having mainstream respectability. And that's sort of the history. One of the really interesting things about the book is the history that was sort of lost or forgotten once LSD became this countercultural symbol. And was very quickly banned. And so he does a good job, I think, of reminding us about what was going on. Before Leary arrived on the scene, there was all kinds of interesting research going on. I think he's Pollan is maybe a little bit too easy on the press and the politicians who were responsible for this panic about LSD that led to its prohibition. It's true that Leary was... you know, deliberately provocative. He was trying to be provocative. But, you know, the government did not have to respond in the way that it did. And it didn't respond in a rational way.
In the end, and we'll get to this, you critique or you criticize Pollan for, you know, basically saying, you know, these are really, psychedelics are good things. They can be good things, but we really have to leave them in the hands of experts.
It's not clear to me actually what his policy position is. Mm-hmm. One of the things that he emphasizes is that these are powerful substances. You need rules surrounding them. It's not necessarily legal rules. Mm-hmm. He doesn't say that. He doesn't say, you know, you need to get permission from the government to do it. And in fact, he does want, for people like him, who is, you know, he has no particular diagnosis. He hasn't gone to a doctor and who has told him you need to take this drug to treat this condition you have. He wants he wants well people, is the way he puts it, you know, to be able to use these drugs for self-exploration, for spiritual purposes, and so on.
Long as they're artisanal and organically grown, based
on his
food
writing.
Well, I mean,
in the book, he describes a bunch of trips that he took on LSD, on psilocybin, toad venom, even. Yeah. Ayahuasca. And so he's not like I get this freedom. I think he wants other people to have this freedom as well. But I mean, he rightly says that you need to approach the substances with care.
Right.
it's not clear what the policy is that he's advocating.
So let's get to that and your views on that in a second. But let's briefly recover some of that pre-Leary, and it's not even Leary per se, because Leary also did some serious work with psychedelics before he, you know, just was like, fuck it, let's get high all the time, which is a good thing in many ways, certainly a big change. But what was going on in the pre-60s era with psychedelics that's worth recovering?
Well, there was very promising research looking at LSD as a treatment for, that's the way they call it, what they called it, for alcoholism, mm-hmm. Which is something there's renewed interest in that now. Yeah. And then also for anxiety and depression associated with terminal illnesses. And again, that also is being just starting to be explored again with the government's permission. And so you have these lost decades where these substances could have been researched rigorously. They could have been approved
for
use in psychotherapy. And I don't want to blame Timothy Leary for that.
No.
That was the government's fault.
I mean, and some of this is stuff like where Henry Luce, the publisher of Time.
But that's a great example. I mean,
had Time Life magazine, Time and Life magazine at the height of their mass appeal and circulation and cultural authority saying, hey, you know, there's some really interesting new drugs here.
Yes.
That everybody should be thinking about.
Not everybody, but this is sort of where the reframing comes into it, because Henry Luce originally was very enthusiastic about LSD. He and his wife dropped acid under a doctor's
Claire Booth Luce, conservative Republican congresswoman, the playwright.
And they liked it.
Yeah.
And they thought it was, you know, that it could have important benefits,
right?
Important psychological benefits. He also published the first journalistic account of magic mushrooms, of psilocybin mushrooms, in the United States, and he was into this stuff.
Explains maybe the editors of Time were forced to take a lot of drugs, and that's why they kept doing like, oh, the dinosaurs died from volcanic, or you know, the dinosaur diet, you know, with the Virgin Mary or something like that. Weird, trippy, religious.
Yeah, possibly. Although by that time they already had turned against it, and that's what the turnaround happened.
Yeah.
Less than a decade later, after they're running this article about how interesting the psilocybin is,
right.
And you know, Henry Luce is talking about how great LSD was for him and his wife, and less than a decade later, they're running this insane,
could you imagine,
hysterical
like
cover
Rupert
story.
It'd be as if Rupert Murdoch was like in the early days of Fox News.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you know what? You got to go trip it.
Yes. Yeah. And that's what, so what happened? It's not like LSD changed.
Right. And this is also just to button that down a little bit. This is also when Cary Grant, was using LSD.
People were using it in therapy.
Bill W., the founder of AA, was in the AA newsletter, was talking about how, like, you know, I think LSD might be better than booze.
Right.
I
mean, so this was a mainstream, respectable view. And within a few years, all of a sudden, all hell is breaking loose because of LSD, and they're writing these hysterical cover stories in places like Life and Time. So what happened is that the people who were using the substance didn't change. The people who were using the substance changed, and so it was okay for respectable people, you know, under a doctor's supervision, who have fairly conventional views, you know, to be taking these drugs for serious purposes. I mean, that's important, right?
And also for the government or the CIA or the Army to secretly be testing people.
Yeah, I'm not sure what Luce would have said about that. But the point is that there was no political implication. There were no political implications to using LSD until it became identified with the counterculture. And then I think it was inaccurate for people who are pushing it, saying, wow, this is, if you could turn everybody on, everybody will agree with me politically. I mean, that's what a lot of people tended to think. And Leary probably believed something along those lines. A lot of people across the political spectrum really thought that LSD had this sort of revolutionary capability to change people's minds. The problem is the ideas they thought that people would adopt varied from person to person. So obviously the ideas are not inherent in the substance. There's nothing necessarily, it's subversive politically about it. It's subversive in a certain sense. It's subversive of something.
Right.
It enables you to see things from a new perspective, and that can be useful creatively. It can be useful psychologically. It can help people resolve problems. It can just be fun and entertaining. Right. But I think, all right, so you see it moves from being something that's being used by respectable middle-class, middle-aged people to something that is being used by a bunch of stinking hippies.
Yeah, and it's the difference between Aldous Huxley, serious author, Englishman, living in Southern California, writing The Doors of Perception, to The Doors. And then it's like, okay, no, it's done.
Yes.
Like, we got to make this illegal.
So, and so it's partly the who is taking it and why they're taking it. And to the extent that it was perceived as either politically or culturally subversive, that made it look bad. And then, but then also to the extent that it was perceived as a frivolous use, right? It was when Henry Luce used it, that was for serious purposes, and that was good. But to use it just for fun is wrong,
which is truly subversive, right? I mean, in the same sense, I remember a former colleague of ours, Chuck Freund, used to write about kind of popular culture in the Soviet Union. And the thing the Soviet Union, he always said, that they were the most afraid of were not political pop songs. They were songs that had absolutely zero political content and were about a world where politics just didn't matter. So like Paul Anka songs and Neil Sedaka songs, he said, were actually more subversive to the Soviet regime than songs that seemed to have like an overt political message of like be anti-authority, because the Soviets could manage politics. They couldn't manage a world beyond politics. And in an analogous way, the idea that you could be taking LSD or drugs for fun,
right,
as opposed to become a better citizen or to become a better husband or worker or whatever, that really freaks people shit in a weird way.
And I think, I mean, Leary was posing exactly the right questions at the time, and that the title of my book review, Who Controls Your Cortex, that comes from a letter that he wrote in the Harvard Crimson, not long before he was fired.
Yeah.
And by the way, I mean, he was fired because it turned out that an undergraduate had participated in these psilocybin studies, and they weren't supposed to be doing that. But he was addressing, you know, college students at Harvard, saying, if you want to do this kind of self-exploration, who gets to decide whether you're allowed to do that and on what grounds? And these are the right questions to be asking, and they're still relevant, you know, today.
Do you think that Leary, I mean, was he promiscuous in his use? And this is something, if you go back to, I guess it's the Robert Greenfield biography from about a decade ago or so, you know, there is a general animus against Leary, even among people who are very predisposed towards the counterculture, that Leary at some point crossed the line where he was no longer even serious about kind of consciousness raising, and he just basically wanted to get fucked up all the time.
Well, I mean, I think he was a huge self-promoter. He made it seem as if like he was the pioneer in this area, which wasn't really true, certainly scientifically not true. And it wasn't always clear. I mean, if you read the stuff he wrote, which he would always write something new when he had needed like bail money or legal bills.
You know, it is true that he was suffering even before alongside all of that. I mean, he really, like, the federal government really was after him in a serious way.
And he was
constantly, for years, was fighting off a completely insane drug, marijuana.
It was crazy. I mean, it was a tiny amount of marijuana, and they treated him like he was some kind of threat to public safety, based on that charge. But I mean, the real threat, obviously, was what he was doing, what he was saying.
Yeah.
His speech was the real threat. So I think it is. I mean, it is subversive to say, I don't need any special reason or government approved reason. I will, you know, decide if whether I want to use the substance and for what reasons seem good to me. And so it's only by backing away from that, though, that you're starting to see these substances being legally rehabilitated.
Right.
It's only by putting them back into this scientific pseudo-medical frame that you are starting to see progress toward loosening the laws a bit.
Talk a bit about that, because obviously ecstasy or MDMA and psilocybin and whatnot are actually going through a reevaluation process by the federal government to be accepted as legitimate, as medicines that actually have a use, as opposed to just substances that have to be banned.
Right. So, I mean, MDMA, not everybody considers that to be a psychedelic, but it has aspects of psychedelic to it. Some people call it an empathogen because of the way it promotes empathy. But analogous to LSD in the sense that before it was banned, psychotherapists were finding it very useful. Mm-hmm. And if you've tried it, you know why. And if you look at the research that led the FDA to identify MDMA as a breakthrough therapy, meaning it looks like it's substantially better than all the existing remedies or treatments for PTSD specifically. Mm-hmm. That's the application they're looking at right now, post-traumatic stress disorder. You will see very dramatic changes. Mm-hmm. I mean, so these people, there have been a number of studies. These are conducted under the sponsorship of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, which has accomplished something amazing. Yeah. Basically since the ban, they've been working toward getting this approved, and I thought it would never happen. They did whatever the government told them they had to do. Whatever bureaucratic hoop they had to jump through, they did. And they did the research is very compelling. If you look at so we're looking phase two studies. They've already started, as of September, started phase three clinical studies. And they think it may be approved by the FDA as soon as 2021. But if you look at the phase two studies, you see people come in. One study was mainly veterans and some like first responders. Another study involved crime victims. They've been conducted at various sites by different people. But what you find is people come in, they've got a PTSD diagnosis. Often their score, they use the scale to measure how severe your symptoms is, how severe your problem is. And you see, after the first session, you see already a substantial reduction. And what's especially impressive about this is not only does the improvement persist, but it actually improves more over the course of the year following the last session. You see more improvement. And so you look at these studies, these people come in, they all have diagnoses. And by the end of it, I mean, it depends on the study, but one, for example, 3/4 of them no longer qualified for the diagnosis because their scores fell below the cutoff. That's amazing. I mean, you don't often see that kind of in any research. You don't often see an effect that dramatic.
So here's a larger question for you, though. So, you know, the people at MAPS and, you know, Rick Doblin is the engine behind all of that and really has pulled off a tremendous achievement of, you know, I don't want to say beating the government at its own game, but like actually following the rules and bringing something back.
Right.
You were a huge admirer of Thomas Saws, longtime Reason contributing editor, a critic of the medicalization of society. How does it make you feel that, you know, one of the ways that, you know, pot was made legal,
right,
and it's being made legal is by medicalizing it, you know, in these substances? It's kind of odd, isn't it? That it seems to be working.
Yes, I think the pot example shows that it does work. It's disconcerting to me. I'm not comfortable with it. Zaz himself condemned the idea of medical marijuana. He said anybody should be able to use whatever substance they want without any permission, any special reason. And it's just right. But I felt this is a move in the right direction, at least. It's at least some people get to use it for some purposes. And that's better than no one, right?
Right.
Arresting everybody. But what happened in the case of marijuana is that it was the medicalization of it that helped rehabilitate its image, reassure people. Because first of all, you actually have sick people who are using this as medicine, you have to worry about the side effects. Well, what are the side effects? There aren't that many. There aren't that many things to worry about.
But it's also, if you have AIDS wasting syndrome, you know, the side effects aren't so bad.
No.
If you're actually helping somebody.
Yes. Yeah. And you see people who really, now look, there are a lot of people in California who are getting it for all kinds of minor complaints and whatever. But when you look at seriously ill people who this really improves their lives and enables them, you know, to eat, keep food down, it relieves serious pain, this kind of stuff. That's compelling. And it means that this substance has benefits, and that the downside, i.e. the side effects, they're not huge.
Right.
It's not a big concern. So that really did help. And now lots of Americans who maybe did not have direct experience with marijuana before, they now maybe have a relative, an elderly relative or, you know, a sibling or whatever, who used this medically, and it worked for them. So that had a big influence, I think, on public opinion. In the case of the psychedelics, you mentioned psilocybin. We get to the psilocybin studies, but it's the same kind of framing, but even more like official, because it's actually they're trying to get FDA approval. And now, what I would say is, I don't think these things are diseases. I should say that PTSD, I don't think is a disease. It's a problem. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's a psychological issue. And it is completely plausible to me that MDMA could help resolve that or alleviate it because of the way that it enables people to confront these traumas. And by the way, this kind of therapy they're doing with the MDMA is very client or patient directed, right? So basically they take the MDMA and they lie on a couch and there's a couple of therapists there to help out if necessary, but not they're not giving a lot of firm guidance. They're not exercising a lot of control over the situation. So basically the idea is that this makes people less fearful of confronting their traumas and more able to work through these issues. And it really, I mean, it sounds like yeah. it's made up, but if you talk to people who've done this, who had problems for years where they, you know, would have panic reactions all the time, they couldn't sleep at night, it was like really messing up their lives. And now you have dramatic, I mean, in some cases, dramatic improvements after the first session.
Right. I mean, and it's not like they're, you know, they're going on maintenance,
right.
You know, ecstasy for the rest of your life, take, you know, drop a couple of hits every day or anything like that.
It's not just to suppress symptoms. Right. It's to actually help them resolve the situation so that they don't have the symptoms anymore. And that's, I mean, just the sleep alone. If you have trouble sleeping all the time, that's going to fuck up your life, no matter what else happens to you. So this is a big deal. If you can get this kind of dramatic progress, and it's serving as a catalyst for this psychological process. Right. It's not like Prozac or these other drugs that you're taking every day, either to
Viagra, Cialis,
manage your mood or relieve symptoms or whatever. Right. So it's different in that way. And LSD is the same kind of idea. Yeah. Psilocybin, the same. They're not things that you're taking as a regular medicine every day. You're taking them just one or two or three times, and it can still have this dramatic effect.
It's amazing. Some of the MAP stuff we're talking about PTSD, you know, it for so long we've taken it for granted. I mean, you were a psychology major as an undergrad, right?
Yeah.
So as was I. And like, it was taken for granted that one single event, traumatic, could like ruin your life. Like you could never get past it. But the flip of that, the idea that you could have one intense peak experience that you could also kind of live off.
Yes.
It's amazing that it's taken so long to flip that script.
And that the second thing would be the antidote for the first thing.
And it makes
sense psychologically, but people, until they've actually looked at the data or tried it themselves, I mean, like the first time I tried MDMA, I thought this can't possibly like do
what
people say. No, they can't possibly what people claim, but it really does have this. Now, granted, this is not a blind study or anything like that, but it was qualitatively different from other kinds of drug experiences in the way that it encourages emotional candor and feelings of closeness and trust. And that's, you know, very in a psychotherapeutic context, these are very important things.
Well, I was going to ask you, did you, MDMA, I guess, it was actually made illegal in 85 and it became effectively illegal, I think, in 86, something.
Well, it was a temporary ban. The DEA basically banned it. And then they have to wait a while for public comment and stuff. Yeah. And then it's officially.
Because I mean, what I was going to ask you is, did you take ecstasy before MDMA? Have you ever taken it when it was legal versus when it was illegal?
Oh, I only take drugs when they're legal. So,
back when Eddie's like, you know, putting air quotes on. No, I'm just curious because I had taken, there was a, in the early 80s, there, you know, it became a party drug, essentially.
Right.
And it was also fascinating to me because I remember the rhetoric about ecstasy was kind of like, you know, this is one of the reasons it's dangerous is, first off, kids started taking it. So the minute, you know, at various points, it's black people, it's musicians, it's Mexicans, it's this, it's that. And then it's like when it gets to kids, you're screwed. But it was seen as somewhat antisocial because like you kind of could hang out by yourself or with a single friend and listen to music or something. It was banned. And then it was like the next time I took it, it had really become a kind of rave drug.
Right.
Which was not the context I remember taking it in.
Yes. And it's interesting because if you talk to people who were enthusiastic about MDMA before it was banned, people who either underwent psychotherapy or therapists themselves, they find it puzzling, especially if they're older. Like, why would you take it and go to the big dance party. But it just shows you the importance of you know, set and setting,
right.
the context, in terms of influencing your drug experience. But again, that's this pattern with MDMA is the same thing that happened with LSD. It went from being not a government concern to the extent they were aware of it at all. Because it was, who cared? If there were a few psychotherapists who were using this with their clients, but once people started using it for fun, in a sort of party context, then it became unacceptable,
and that's when the
DEA decided to ban it.
And you know who is one of the weird villains, and certainly in the MDMA story, and he's still on the fucking scene as Joe Biden. If you are against the drug war, how big a villain is Joe Biden in your kind of psychic universe?
Well, he created the drug czar. He sponsored the law that makes people broadly liable for felonies. If they, for example, if you have sponsor a rave, or like if you ride a space rave, or you put on a rave, and you're not like giving out MDMA, but people there are using it and you're aware of that, like they can send you to prison for that and take away all your property. And it really is counterproductive because it discourages harm reduction, right? So if you, for example, let, you know, the organization Dance Safe, which does testing, so people get these tablets, they're told it's MDMA, but who the hell knows what it is? They can do testing, they have pamphlets about how to be careful and stay hydrated and all, but not too hydrated, because too much water can be bad.
Yeah.
But, you know, so they give good tips about how to reduce the risks of using MDMA. You'd think you'd want to encourage that if you were like, if you had a musical venue where, you know, there's a rave going on. But if you do that, that shows you have knowledge that there's drug use, and that makes you liable, you know, to be thrown in prison. So you're not going to be, it discourages people from engaging in harm reduction or even allowing harm reduction to go on. So that was crazy. I mean, so that's like the worst kind of,
but
we're going to ban the drug, but we're going to make it as dangerous as we possibly can.
Which is the script,
purpose.
Though, that happens, right, in the drug war again and again, where it's like you ban a substance and then you ban anybody who has knowledge of the substance, so you make it worse and worse. Has Biden, to your knowledge, you know, because he's kind of like the way that Al Gore somehow emerged from like the mid to late 80s as, you know, hosting Senate committee hearings against rock and roll lyrics, to being like the world's greatest Grateful Dead fan when he was running with Bill Clinton or something. Joe Biden has gone from being a unreconstructed drug warrior to America's grandpa. Has he ever walked back any of his anti-drug stuff?
I don't recall specifically. It seems to me that he has come out in favor of certain kinds of sentencing reform. There are a number of Newt Gingrich is a good example.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a real gung-ho drug warrior. But he supports sentencing reform now. So
he must know what's in the indictment that's coming against him or something.
Clinton is a good example where he sort of apologized for taking advantage of the crime issue and sending so many people to prison, increasing sentences and that whole thing. You know, he has seen the error of his ways, at least that's what he says. So that's a bit encouraging. Oh, and you have people like Chuck Grassley, who not even long ago was opposing sentencing reform and saying it's reckless and it's terrible and we have to be tough on crime. And now he's the guy who's demanding that this bill, this prison reform bill that's sitting in the Senate right now, is passed by the House. He's demanding that it also includes sentencing reform. So you never know. I mean, people do change their minds on these issues. And even Trump has given signals that he's coming around. I think the framing of these drugs is crucial, and I think the medicalization reassures people, even though, to my mind, it's misconceived. The idea that, you know, so the other example, recent example, psilocybin used for major depression is the most recent study, and the FDA was so impressed by the results from that again, they designated this a breakthrough therapy. And they've approved it. So this is in phase two. So it's not as far along as the MDMA research. There were prior studies of psilocybin used like LSD was for people with serious illnesses, for, you know, to reduce anxiety and depression and stuff. And again, you get these dramatic results where, you know, the symptoms are cut in half or better, or even better. The measure, you know, the scores on these diagnostic questionnaires. So, you know, that is what, that is the way you make progress with the bureaucracy, you know, the drug bureaucracy in the U.S. And then the question becomes, once one of these things is approved, so MDMA is approved for as a treatment for PTSD, or psilocybin is approved for this for major depression. Well, once it's approved, usually what happens is that doctors can prescribe it for other purposes as well, for off-label uses. So you might start to see, well, you know, this was useful for depression.
I'm giving it may you also a be useful prescription for fun.
Yes. Well, yes.
Go out there.
It depends on what on how they you know, how they specify what regulations they have. I hope that it's not one of these situations where it's like, this can only be used in this particular context under this kind of supervision. I hope that doctors have some freedom to prescribe it for different uses. And then that opens the door, depending upon how like enlightened or tolerant or whatever your doctor is, that might open the door to what is really something like spiritual exploration, but by some kind of medical, under some kind of medical label.
Well, how do you feel about that? Because in the Pollan book or the Pollan book, let's just call it that book. You know, they're one of the things
how to change your mind.
How to change your mind. Yeah. Let's talk about how to change your mind. And I actually, as I was reading it, and it is an interesting book, and I highly recommend Trip by Tao Lin, which came out around the same time. He's a novelist, and it's this kind of insane exploration of Terence McKenna and just tripping on all kinds of psychedelics. And it doesn't have any kind of mysticism or anything in it. It's interesting because he just likes to get fucked up. So it's an interesting counterpoint. I know somebody who used to go up to Millbrook, the estate that Leary and Richard Albert, eventually Ram Dass used to do. And like, even up there, you were saying, you know, Pollan has these, you know, rules, or you know, it doesn't have to be government rules, but there's rules. And Leary he became increasingly kind of dictatorial about under what circumstances you could take LSD, or and what, you know, you're only at this level, so you're in this room and this and that, and all of that kind of stuff. Is that a buzzkill, or should it be the idea? I mean, I guess as proper libertarians, we like the idea that people will form communities and subcommunities with their own rules. But it seems like with psychedelics, even the people who are most in favor of them, you break out of like square conventional society where it's totally illegal, then we're going to use it. And then you start creating your own little church where you're only allowed to take it for these reasons or under these circumstances. Is that just the way it always is? And then in your experience with drugs, you know, is that actually a better way to take them in a specific context where you're looking for some kind of knowledge or some kind of community? Or is it better to have a kind of, you know, wild man on the heath experience where you just, you know, do shit and see what happens?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to pay attention to context, because that has especially with psychedelics, has a huge impact on your experience. So that part is perfectly valid. We should mention there are religious exceptions to the bans on psychedelics. And a longstanding one is for use of peyote by the Native American Church. And then this case that went to the Supreme Court and got a unanimous decision saying that the federal law that protects religious freedom means that people who use ayahuasca as part of their rituals are exempt from the criminal ban, right? They have to be allowed to get their sacrament. Now, that's never flown with something like marijuana, because marijuana is so much more popular and appealing, and they're worried about diversion and so on. But that's sort of interesting, because I mean that exception goes along with the medical exception as being what the government takes to be a good reason, a serious reason, a respectable reason, right? And so just as with, you know, medicalization, I'm torn about that. I'm torn about the religious stuff too, because it's like, just because you say you believe in this deity, why should you get a pass when I get to go to, when I have to go to prison, you know? That doesn't seem fair. But on the other hand, is it better that everybody go to prison as opposed to just some people? You know, so it's troubling, the idea that you have this general law, and the Supreme Court actually ruled that. They said, if you have a rule of general, you know, neutral law of general applicability, the First Amendment does not require exceptions, and that's why Congress passed overwhelmingly passed this Religious Freedom Restoration Act. But it is troubling. The Supreme Court was right that it's troubling because, you know, the classic example is, well, if your religion demands human sacrifice, does that mean, you know, you get an exception to the law against homicide? Now, obviously not. But then the question is, well, how do you decide which laws? And my answer, and I presume yours too, would be if the law actually prohibits something that violates people's rights, then you have to respect it, even if your religion says otherwise. But if it's a bullshit law that says you can't do something that is a peaceful activity that violates no one's rights, then everyone, not just, you know, religious people should get a pass. Everyone should get a pass. Then the law should be abolished. The question is, how do you get from, you know, where we are to that point? And so I can imagine, aside from the specific religious exceptions, you have to establish this is my religion, this use of this substance is important to that religion, and I really believe in this religion. You know, it's really kind of unseemly what the courts do, because they're saying, first of all, is your religion, is this really a religion? Yeah. They have to decide it's a real religion, and they have to make sure that you're sincere. And is it also, they have to assess how important is it for you to take the psychoactive substance as part of your religion? So that's really unseemly. It doesn't seem like something the government should be doing at all. So you have that. And you'll have some kinds of medical use that will be approved where you have to get a doctor's prescription. So if you try to move beyond that, some people have suggested, what if you have these clubs, these organizations that are dedicated to just, you know, serious use of psychedelics? It doesn't have to be religious per se. It doesn't have to be medical. You don't.
It's just that we're not going to enjoy it too much.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That's like, crucial. Don't enjoy it too much. Something like, so the idea is to reassure the public, to reassure politicians that this is going to be used in a serious, controlled way, and yet enable people who don't believe in a particular religion, don't believe in a deity, who don't have a, you know, a psychiatric diagnosis that they can show you, they can still benefit from these substances. And so I don't know if that'll ever happen. I think Rick Doblin has talked about something along those lines as a way of saying, you know, this will make sure that it's done in a controlled context so it won't get out of control. Ultimately, obviously, I think, you know, and if you want to take a substance, the government should not be scrutinizing your reasons for wanting to take it, and that should be up to you. But it's a question of how do you get there from
here? Do you think after, you know, 30 plus years, you know, and it's probably actually more like closer to 40 or 45 years of pills, pharmaceuticals really becoming much more common, do you think the average American or the typical American, if such a thing exists, is kind of more wise about, you know, the idea that, look, we're always trying to change our minds. We're always trying to change the way that we feel. We're trying to modulate, whether it's through food or exercise or some other substance. Are we becoming more mature as a society and taking seriously the idea that, you know, we're stuck in our heads and we want to feel the way we want to feel, and we should expand the palette of, you know, what substances we can do that by?
I don't think so. I think that this is the only reason people think it's okay is because it's identified as a medicine. And you see that very clearly with like performance-enhancing drugs, stimulants, for example. Adderall. Okay, so you have an ADHD diagnosis. Nowadays, you could get one. You know, a middle-aged man can get an ADHD diagnosis, and you can get a prescription, and you can use your Adderall, and that's fine. That's a medicine. You have a disease. This is the treatment for it. If, you know, you're a kid takes Adderall because he's studying for an exam or trying to finish a paper, that's abuse, which just seems insane. Like, why is that abuse? It's not abuse. It's use. It's a very functional kind of use. It's you know, improving your performance by definition. That's your aim in doing it. So that's kind of messed up the way that people think about drugs. They need to have a doctor's permission in some way. Even for something that is obviously recreational, like I think you mentioned Viagra, where, okay, so Viagra is to treat a condition, erectile dysfunction, right? But now it's very easily available from doctors will prescribe it just for people who want to improve their sex lives for fun. I mean, that's for fun.
Along with airplane glue, which they don't even make anymore, but like airplane glue and Viagra were like pure fun drugs.
Yeah. So, but the problem, of course, is that there is no regulatory category for fun drugs.
Right.
You cannot go to the FDA and says, we think this drug, you know, say this, we think this drug will promote fun, especially at parties. It's going to be really good parties. we think
so
this
it's
drug
like silly
will
string
enable
that
you
eat.
To enjoy terrible movies more and you know, make you appreciate music or food, a taste of food, right? No, you know, there's no such category. You would have to say it's to treat some kind of deficit, some kind of disorder. And then maybe
and you don't think socially we're not getting or societally we're not getting closer to kind of let's drop the pretense and just say, look, you know, we're all going to be here for, you know, 50 to 200 years. We're going to have, you know, we're going to go through moods and we want to be able to regulate. We're not really getting closer to the idea that as individuals, we're in charge of our consciousness and we should be given broader scope to affect how we feel.
Sadly, no, I don't think so. I think, case of marijuana, you did see that happen. You said, let's drop the pretense. I mean, that's pretty much what happened in California. Mm-hmm. I mean, California had a very loose medical marijuana regime. Right. It was very easy to go to a doctor, get a note, and it could apply anything that the doctor thought could be relieved with marijuana. So it's very open-ended. And people would say, this is basically legalization, but we're pretending it's not. Right. And so I think that is basically what happened. But people do not extrapolate from that to say, what's the principle here? All they know now is that marijuana, they used to think it was really terrible, and it's actually not so bad. Right. And so therefore, it's acceptable to allow that. But
so
every
it's
time
really
you're talking about a new example,
replicating that
yes,
with
you
got
it every single time. Yeah.
And do you feel, I mean, you've written a lot about the opioid epidemic or problems stemming from that. And harm reduction, you know, so there, you know, there's the fun stuff like, okay, we're not going to let you just take drugs for fun, you know, for a while. But then has harm reduction on the other kind of on the opposite end of things, has harm reduction made inroads into the way people think about the war on drugs?
I think so. I mean, if you look at something like needle exchange, which was tremendously controversial back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. It is now not just legal, and in fact, there's an exception in the federal drug paraphernalia statute for distributing drug paraphernalia in compliance with state law, which means that if needle exchange is legal in your jurisdiction, it's not going to be a violation of federal law, and it even gets federal funding. I mean, I don't think it should, but right. so that shows that here's something that was tremendously controversial, a harm reduction measure that is now a consensus issue, more or less. Naloxone, same thing. And that happened, I think, faster that pretty much everybody, except for like the governor of Maine, agrees that Paula Page, who vetoed a bill to make naloxone available over the counter, pretty much everybody agrees that the naloxone should be widely available. Not just doctors should have it, but users should have it, their friends, their relatives, anybody who might be around them, because it can quickly reverse an overdose and save people's lives. And that seems like a no-brainer, unless your attitude is like Paula Page's, which is no. If we reassure people that they might not die when they use heroin, you're just going to get more people using heroin, and people will be less who use it already will be less likely to quit. This just encourages that bad behavior. So the logic of that is that you want drug use to be as dangerous as possible, the better to discourage it. Right. And I think it's a reprehensible argument. Morally, it's completely unacceptable and outrageous, but it is an argument. I mean, and it's a cost benefit, it's sort of utilitarian argument.
On a pragmatic level, about the cost, does it have any effect, though? I mean, people who are likely to overdose, are they like, the only thing that's keeping me shooting up or something is the fact that I have a drug in my pocket that might help me come back.
I mean, the argument is,
just pragmatically,
that it makes people, I guess, less likely to quit, but also maybe more reckless.
Yeah.
Like maybe you don't take a test shot instead of, you just do the whole dose at once because, maybe, I'm not going to say that it's not possible. We know other examples. They call it, moral hazard, right? Where you would make something safer, less dangerous, people tend to do more of it. It's seatbelts encourage more reckless driving, that kind of thing. So it's possible. I'm not going to say that doesn't happen. I'm just saying, what I'm saying is it is outrageous to use that argument as a justification for keeping people, away from this antidote that could save their lives, because it's going to save some lives.
Right.
And you're not supposed to be worrying about this whole collectivist, cost-benefit analysis. You're supposed to be saying, here's somebody whose life could be saved. We should make this available. You certainly shouldn't legally prevent somebody from getting something that can save his life.
So your review essay about the Michael Pollan book, How to Change Your Mind, is called Who Controls Your Cortex? You have three daughters, and I guess one of them is of legal age, but who controls their cortex as a parent and as a libertarian? How do you talk to your kids about the use of intoxicants, legal or illegal? And does it matter if it's legal or illegal?
What I say is that every drug can be used or abused, and it is not contingent on its legal status. Every drug has risks. Every drug has benefits. And if they want more information, they can ask me about it. I'm happy to talk to them.
If you live in my house, you play by my rules.
I'm not going to foist it on them when they're not interested. I'll give you an example. It happened recently. Our middle daughter, who is be 16 in January, she had a conversation with one of her teachers where the teacher made the mistake of asking, "What does your dad do for a living?" And so May's like, "Oh, he writes about
drug abuse."
Yeah, so in fact, he's working on this article about marijuana legalization right now. And the teacher looked kind of troubled. And I think she said, like, "So what do you think about that?"
Yeah.
And my daughter said, "Well, I think marijuana is really not that bad. It's like, it's a fun drug and it's not really that damaging," or words to that effect. And the teacher is even more appalled. She goes, "Are you on drugs right now?" and my daughter said, "No." And the teacher said, "Because you're saying some really wacky things right now." So she related this anecdote. And I gave some kind of flippant response or something, but then I felt bad afterward. It's like maybe she wanted me to talk about it more and get more information. So I approached her the next day and said, "You mentioned this thing about marijuana. I don't know if I really addressed the issue you were raising adequately. Did you have questions about it?" And she was like, "No, I'm good." And so that's fine. I'm not going to, make her listen to all the facts about the relative hazards of, alcohol versus marijuana if she's not interested. But I want them to know that when they are interested in those things, that they can talk to me about it. You have to obviously, the one way in which decisions about drugs are contingent on the legality, obviously, is for practical reasons that certain things can get you arrested and certain other things. Any of these drugs can get you arrested if you're a minor, I guess. Right. But the penalties are going to be more severe for the illegal drugs. So that is something certainly to be aware about. And, all this, they're not at all interested in the Fourth Amendment stuff. Although my daughter at her school, the youngest daughter, is at a middle school where they're starting this random search program to make it seem like the school is going to be safe. And were they going to go around roving with these wands? Metal detecting wands. They're supposedly going to be randomly choosing groups of students to be wanded and opening
What is in the wand? Is it
It's a magical wand. It's one of those metal detecting wands that they use at the airport. And they're they don't want to buy the metal detectors to put at the entrance.
But wait, are they searching for weapons or
weapons,
are they searching
weapons
for drugs?
Okay. Now, here's what happens though. They're supposedly looking for weapons. While they do these so-called random searches, they're also going to be opening the kids' bags because maybe there's a gun in there.
Yeah.
And if they open the bag and they find a bag of weed, So when that came up, I was outraged, obviously. I called the ACLU and I wrote a blog post about it. And I asked my daughter about it. So she's 12. And she thought it was outrageous. That was her initial reaction. Is like, that's not like she's going to be bringing guns or drugs to school, but that it was an outrageous invasion of privacy. And what is that about? And how is that even going to accomplish anything? This is supposed to prevent, by the way, a mass shooter. This is the idea is that that somehow this program of randomly, like, all the kids in this hallway who are still in the hallway during when the tardy bell rings are going to be searched. And that somehow is going to deter a mass murderer from coming in and shooting people. So it's ridiculous. I mean, it's security theater, but it's like very invasive security theater. And so she got that. I mean, on a sort of gut level. But my fear is that over time, if they actually implement this policy, that kids get used to that sort of thing and they sort of take it for granted. And then as adults, when they're pulled over, for example, and the cop says, "You mind if I search your car?" He's like, "Yes, you mind." That's what you're supposed to say. But I'm afraid they'll be conditioned to think, that's what they do. They just search you for no reason and that's okay. So I worry about that.
Well, we're going to leave it there. I've been talking with Jacob Solem, Reason senior editor. His most recent piece in Reason magazine is a review essay about Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. Jacob's piece is called Who Controls Your Cortex? What are you working on next? Do you have a long story or project?
Yeah, I have a piece I just finished up, which is a package of stories about what happens to people with marijuana records in jurisdictions that have legalized marijuana. Yeah. Because if you just because it's legal now, you still have a record, and it still affects your life, and you know the kinds of jobs you can get, and whether you can.
And what's the very quick preview? A wide range of responses.
Yeah, I mean,
right?
The states vary widely in how they treat this issue. California, at this point, is the best because they not only included expungement of marijuana records in the initiative itself, but they also passed a law just recently that's going to automate the process. So the state's going to be responsible for identifying people whose records might be either expunged or downgraded, like from a felony to a misdemeanor. And then if prosecutors don't object within a certain period of time, it'll be expunged automatically.
And then
so that's the best law.
What's the worst state?
Alaska is the worst state. Hmm. There is no process of expungement or sealing of criminal records at all in Alaska. Theoretically, you can get a pardon for the governor, but the governor has not given a pardon since 2006.
And the last time I checked, all of the candidates for governor and the governor themselves, like they're dropping out of the race. I don't know if you've been, it's been a very odd series of events.
Yeah, so, Canada has this, it was interesting. They did a few interesting things that were pretty good when they legalized marijuana in Canada. Letting the state be the sole distributor, like they're doing in Quebec, is not such a great idea.
Right.
But one of the things they did is it wasn't in the initial package of legislation, but they are promising to pass a bill that addresses people, at least some people, basically minor possession cases, to expedite it. So you still would have to, they're going to eliminate the fee, they're going to eliminate waiting periods to make it easier. It's still not automatic. But at the same time they're legalizing, they're also thinking about, well, what about all these other people who already got screwed over under the previous legal regime? Something's not, you're convicted of something, it's not a crime anymore. We decided it really shouldn't be a crime, so it's really not just for you to continue to suffer over that. And it's similar, I point out, so what happened after alcohol prohibition is that both Roosevelt and state governors thought that once you repeal that, people shouldn't have to have these records anymore. And they issued lots of pardons for people who had violated alcohol prohibition. Something similar is owed to people who violated marijuana.
Yeah, the unwinding of the drug war, which obviously is not even, you know, we're in the very early stages of it ending, but it'll take decades, if not centuries, really, to unwind all of it.
Well, my hope is, because since I previously had been like too pessimistic about progress, I never thought that marijuana would be legalized this soon. You know, I thought before I died it would happen, but I would be pretty old. So I don't want to be too pessimistic, and I'm going to predict that like within a decade, this will be resolved at the federal level. And maybe that is even too pessimistic because there are all kinds of issues that come up for the industry, obviously, as a result of the continued federal prohibition. It creates all sorts of weird problems.
And it's true that countries are changing. I mean, Canada and other places.
Yeah, well, Canada legalized.
Mexico, what is like decriminalized marijuana?
Yeah, well,
or is moving to
Canada
that?
Legalized at the, unlike the U.S., legalized at the national level.
Right.
I mean, it's not like it's going province to province, and they've got a conflict. Yeah. So that's better in that way. Yeah, Mexico, they just had a Supreme Court ruling, the effect of which is to say that people cannot be punished for marijuana consumption or for activities related to that. So if you grow at home for your own use, or you possess it for use, or even like transfer it without compensation, that is not something you can be criminally punished for. That's a violation of your rights to do that. So that implies that people with cases pending should be able to get them dismissed, and that prosecutions won't be able to go forward. The incoming president has said he's interested in actual legalization, so you may there, as in Canada, have a legal cannabis industry.
Suddenly we're going to have to rewrite NAFTA. Again, right?
Yes.
You know, because the Canadian and Mexican marijuana industries, which in a lot of ways have been eating our lunch for a long time anyway. So,
Well, I mean, I think America is doing pretty well in producing good cannabis.
Good
Okay. I mean,
so it's kind of like beer. I mean, we're microbrews.
Yes. Look, you go to states where that have legalized. I mean, it's a bewildering array of different strains and products.
How much of that, and I'm sorry to extend, we were supposed to wrap up, but how much of that is just kind of horseshit? Like when you go to a wine bar, where it's like, you know what, you're going to feel this, you know, in your chest and in your legs,
right,
but
this
not
is a
in
body
your
high
head.
To a head high. And
I
am somewhat skeptical of those. Yeah. I mean, the claim is it has to do with the concentration of different cannabinoids in that particular strain. And it's probably not consistent with, I mean, it's not consistent among the things that have that, are given that name.
And then like everybody's
and then
a little bit different.
It's not clear you're going to detect it really. Yeah. So I'm skeptical of that. The one thing that that is true, which I used to think was bullshit, is that these different strains that have names that connote a certain smell or taste, they really do. Yeah. I mean, as with wines or beers, they really, you can smell if it's blueberry, whatever. Right. And it's not like they're spraying blueberry shit on it. It's like, it has some of the same chemicals in there that are in whatever makes blueberry smell the way blueberries smell, the lemon, you know, lemon, whatever.
Yeah.
It actually does smell and taste a bit like that. So that's kind of cool. And it's like, I mean, when you're on the black market, you take whatever you can get. You're not getting, first of all, it may not be fresh. It may be shitty and swag. And you don't even know what strain it is usually. And so that's like the first time you walk into a store with all these, you know, containers to sample and smell, and it's pretty cool. I mean,
this is, you know, it's interesting that the drug war, you know, part of where it goes to end is in the artisanal revolution, right? Where people suddenly have started caring. We care more about how we decorate our houses, how we make stuff, how we cook stuff, where the food comes from.
Yeah.
It all, you know, it all kind of points to, you know, in a way it makes the drug war harder to prosecute, I think.
Well, and it's, you know, an answer for the people who worry that all like the mom and pop cannabis businesses are going to be, you know, driven out of the market by the big, you know, corporations going to come in.
Corporate pot is the worst.
Yes,
it's soulless.
The idea is that you will have, you know, the Budweiser of marijuana, and that's what most people. Now, that might be true. Most people may smoke the Budweiser marijuana, but there always will be.
Call it the Marlboro marijuana, right? You don't hear people complaining, oh, you know, that. I guess there's the American Spirit tobacco products, and then there's your roll your own and all that.
But I think there will always be a market among connoisseurs who care more about who care how it smells and how it tastes, and also about all the different levels, the different cannabinoids which they can detect. You know, that this will accomplish a certain goal for them, whereas this other strain, this is one for relaxing on the couch, this is one for getting work done, which, by the way, I never found any strain of marijuana that's good for that. Maybe that's just me, but...
Well, now we're going back to talk about amphetamines, right? You know, so... Well, we're going to end it there, but we have been talking with Jacob Sullum, senior editor of Reason. Check out his article, Who Controls Your Cortex, in the 50th anniversary issue of Reason. Jacob, thanks for talking.
Thank you.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I have been Nick Gillespie, your host. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, at Google Play, at Reason.com, or wherever. And when you get a chance, rate and review us. Let us know how we're doing. Thanks for listening.